The following is an encore broadcast of Jazz Profiles. Red Norvo died at the age of 91 on April 6th, 1999.
He brought the xylophone into jazz. The xylophone was a vaudeville instrument which played the corniest music you could imagine. And somehow, Red Norvo managed to transform that instrument into a singing melodic instrument. That is absolutely extraordinary.
You know, Red Norvo was a great musician, a very subtle musician. And the more you listen to him, the more you appreciate what he was doing. He had such wonderful taste, and he swung so lightly.
Swinging all the time. He loved to swing. And, well, they called him Mr. Swing. He was one of the swingingest players I knew.
In a field in which such words as innovator, genius, groundbreaker, pathfinder are thrown around very indiscriminately, it would be my contention that he is one of those deserving of every such encomium anybody can think of.
They called him Mr. Swing, a consummate improviser, a musician's musician, capable and comfortable playing in virtually any style, from ragtime to swing to bebop. He was the first to play jazz on mallet instruments, beginning on xylophone and marimba, and later on the vibes. And with his wife, Mildred Bailey, he led one of the most respected big bands of the swing era and helped to launch the career of many important jazz musicians. I'm Nancy Wilson, and this is Jazz Profiles. On this show, a tribute to one of the great innovators in jazz, Red Norvo. Over the years, Red has mastered three different mallet instruments, those with wooden keys, the higher-pitched xylophone, and the deeper-sounding marimba, and the all-metal instrument commonly called the vibraphone, or vibes. But Red is particular about what he calls his instrument, preferring the brand name given by its manufacturer, Deegan.
Now this one here would be called a vibraharp, see? That's a marimba over there. That's a four-octave marimba. Now, in the garage out in back, I got a xylophone.
That's what Red calls the xylophone, the xylophone. And he calls his vibraphone the vibraharp. So it shouldn't come as much of a surprise that he calls himself Red Norvo, even though his real name is Kenneth Norville. That's the name he was given when he was born in the sleepy river town of Beardstown, Illinois, back in 1908. He was the fourth and last child of Joseph and Estelle Norville. His father was a dispatcher for the local railroad who played piano. His mother was a former trumpet player, determined to give her children a musical education. She arranged for Red to take piano lessons with a local woman when he was 8 years old.
And all of a sudden she realized I made a mistake or something. She realized that I was doing everything by ear, and she hit me on the hand with a ruler. You've been lying to me? She got mad at me. I never went back after that. That's all the lessons I ever had.
Although Red gave up piano lessons, he didn't give up his interest in music. In 1921, when a flood in his hometown forced his family to evacuate to Rolla, Missouri, where his two brothers were going to college, Red got to see a show at the local movie theater that changed his life forever.
Yeah, they had a little band, a college band, in the pit. I would be there the first night to get this front seat because there was a guy that played a marimba. And every night I'm there, I'm watching him, trying to figure out how he's doing things. So finally after, maybe 2 or 3 weeks, he said to me, "Hey, kid." "Yeah." He said, "Yeah, I think you're interested in this machine, are you?" I said, "Yeah, I really am. I like it. I like to watch you play." And he said, "Up in the fraternity house in my room, there's a spoolman. I'll leave some mallets on it. And if you want to go up, I'll tell the lady who's the head of the fraternity house, that if you come by, to take you up there and let you play that." So that's the way I got started. Then I was determined I was going to get one.
Red soon bought himself a xylophone and set about teaching himself how to play it. He would listen to records on the family's Victrola, picking out notes and chords. The records that had the greatest impact on Red were pop tunes and light classics performed by George Hamilton Green, then considered the Dean of Mallet Players in America. In the 1920s, mallet players like George Hamilton Green were the rage, both as recording stars and on the vaudeville circuit. When Red graduated from high school, he packed up his xylophone and traveled to Chicago, hoping to try his hand in show business. There he linked up with a marimba band called the Collegians and began touring vaudeville houses. Red spent the long train rides between engagements, educating himself by reading books on music theory, and he practiced incessantly, even in the theaters while he was working.
The first day in the theater, if I watched the picture that was going to be playing when the vaudeville wasn't on, I could tell when I'd have to stop. I said, well, I can play about 20 minutes now, and I have a little stopwatch on the top of the marimba, and I could play like practice scales for like 15 minutes, you know, just run all the different scales. And if I got too loud, the projection engineer would call backstage, tell that redheaded kid to shut up.
As Red increased his showmanship, he became more and more successful on the vaudeville circuit, earning up to $650 a week, big money in those days. But he was becoming restless. As he traveled the country, he was becoming more and more aware of this new music that would come to be called jazz. He bought himself a Victrola, which he often played backstage.
So when I went up to Chicago, I found a bunch of musicians on State Street there, and they helped me get the record, Louis Records, with Earl Hines. And I kept playing those records every once in a while. I didn't have them loud, extra loud, but I guess you could hear him, the band in the pit at East Turtle, because the drummer came to me and said, hey, kid, you really like that music, don't you?
By his love of what was then called hot music, Red was anxious to get out of vaudeville. He began leading dance bands, first in a Milwaukee ballroom and then in Minneapolis. In 1930, he moved to Chicago to take a network radio job and to work with bandleader Ben Burney at the Sherman Hotel. Red was now playing a 7-foot-long, 5-octave instrument that was a combination of marimba and xylophone. In between sets by the band, Red would push his instrument around the room from table to table like a strolling violinist, playing a combination of popular songs and his own 4 mallet arrangements of jazz tunes, including a couple written by trumpeter Bix Beiderbecke.
And then one night, a bunch of guys came in, and they were pretty bagged. They'd been drinking, so they sat there at the table, and they were noisy and laughing and everything. I just pulled the instrument over and played. I didn't let noise bother me. I just played one of Bix's tunes. And this big guy said, hey, you, did you hear what that kid just played? Wasn't that Bix's tune? So that was it. And I pushed it back and the band went on and everything. I never thought no more about it.
Drunken man that Red didn't recognize was none other than Paul Whiteman. In 1930, Paul Whiteman was easily the most popular and powerful band leader in America. Dubbed the King of Jazz, Whiteman presided over a Chicago-based table of talent, including William Grant Still, Ferdy Groffay, Bing Crosby, and his immensely popular girl singer, Mildred Bailey. Impressed by Red's playing, Whiteman returned a few days after their initial encounter and offered Red a full-time job on radio. One of his first radio assignments was to accompany Mildred as part of a small jazz-oriented group. Red was immediately smitten by her singing.
It was the first time I heard the words of a song. Mildred's diction was so great that every time she sang a song, you knew what the words were. And she marries the music and the words so well.
Tragedy, tragedy, here is my catastrophe. Tragedy, tragedy, my man's gone from me. Comedy, comedy, I suppose the joke's on me. Mystery, mystery, where can my man be?
Stop. Red and Mildred's professional relationship blossomed into a romance, and they were married in 1931. By this time, Red had become a featured attraction with the Whiteman Band, performing show-stopping solo numbers using 4 and even 6 mallets. When the band got to New York City, Red was given his first real opportunity to showcase his mallet playing on record. It was a recording that would become Mildred Bailey's theme song, Hoagy Carmichael's Rockin' Chair. Jazz trumpeter Dick Sudhalter is the author of Lost Chords.
What astonishes me listening to that record is the utter polish and assurance of what Red is playing as a backup to her. He knows exactly what he's doing. He's playing obbligato material, which is both harmonically quite sophisticated. He's already worked out the rhythmic problems. For example, the xylophone couldn't sustain notes, so he worked out ways of trilling, either on one note or on close intervals, such as a third or a fourth. How did he arrive at that? And of course, he and I have known each other for a long time, and I have asked him questions like that, and of course, inevitably, the answer is going to be, well, I don't know, I just figured it out.
My dear old Aunt Harriet, in heaven she be. Send me sweet chariot for the end of these troubles I'll see. Old rocking chair gets it. Judgment day.
Hoagy Carmichael's Rockin' Chair, with Mildred Bailey on vocals, recorded in August 1932, one of the earliest recordings to feature the playing of Red Norvo. You're listening to a tribute to the life and music of Red Norvo. On NPR's Jazz Profiles, I'm Nancy Wilson. In 1933, Red Norvo and Mildred Bailey left the Whiteman Band and settled in the New York suburb of Forest Hills. Signing a contract with Brunswick, Red began to make more records, this time as a leader. For his first recording date, Norvo wrote a piece of music to showcase his virtuosity on the xylophone. He called it Hole in the Wall. In addition to writing jazz-oriented pieces like Hole in the Wall, Red also had an interest in experimenting with pieces inspired by the European classical tradition. Again, historian Dick Sudhalter.
Red got to talking with another guy who was associated with Brunswick at the time, a guy named Morty Palitz. Through Morty Palitz's urging, Red actually sneaked into the studio one night and recorded two much more audacious, much more daring compositions than Hole in the Wall and Knockin' on Wood had been. One of them was Red's setting of Bix Beiderbecke's In a Mist, and the other was a thing called Dance of the Octopus.
Composer and historian Gunther Schuller.
The Dance of the Octopus just goes way out into beyond bitonality, which is two keys at once, and polytonality, which is many keys, three or four at once, into atonality. And that was absolutely unheard of in jazz. Even Ellington did not do that until quite a few years later, maybe 5 to 10 years later. I mean, the whole thing was so adventurous, so courageous musically, and so modern that it just almost defies explanation. You know, how could this happen in 1933? And in this tiny little 3-minute piece, you know.
Red Norvo's composition, Dance of the Octopus, Dick Sudhalter.
Jack Capp was running Brunswick at the time he later founded Decca Records. Jack Capp summoned Red to his office and very calmly said, what were those two things you did? And Red started to explain. And while he was explaining, Capp had his contract in his hand and was very slowly tearing it into little pieces. At the end of which, he handed the pile of pieces back to Red and said, here's your contract.
It was an awful time in my life. I never was so hit in the face with something. I enjoyed writing those things that I had written, and I thought, if this two go, I'll be able to record the other solos that I'd written for Four Hammers. But I took the numbers, I'd written them all out. I took them and I threw them in the fireplace. If I tried to play any one of those things now, I couldn't.
Red Norvo's recording of Dance of the Octopus was to confound and amaze musicians for years to come. Vibraphonist Gary Burton first heard the piece in the 1960s.
I listened to it over and over for the first week or two that I had it, just kind of letting it sink in that here was a guy that was already 30 years before me doing all these things that I thought that I had been discovering on my own, and I realized that he'd been there already. I guess it was like finding somebody else's tracks in the sand after you think you've found a new undiscovered island or something.
Another person who was impressed with these experimental pieces was record producer John Hammond. Hammond pressured Brunswick to release these recordings, and they became a critical success worldwide. Hammond also arranged a couple of recording dates with Red as the leader. They featured a who's who of rising jazz stars: tenor saxophonist Charlie Barnett and Chewberry, drummer Gene Krupa, clarinetist Artie Shaw, and pianist Teddy Wilson. Jazz historian Dick Sudhalter.
Probably what strikes the ear most powerfully about both those sessions was Red's ability to find and combine his component sidemen. But it's on the blues in E-flat that you really find some remarkable things going on. If you make a comparison between Teddy Wilson's piano solo and Novo's xylophone solo, you realize that they are on what we call a wavelength to a rather astonishing degree. It's almost as if one is second-guessing the other, and both solos rendered on paper in transcription could have been the work of one man.
Swing Octet with Blues in E-flat, featuring Teddy Wilson on piano and Red Norvo on the xylophone. I'm Nancy Wilson. Just ahead, Red Norvo and his arranger Eddie Sauter give big band jazz a soft, subtle swing. You're listening to Jazz Profiles, a tribute to the music of Red Norvo from NPR, National Public Radio. In the early part of the 1930s, Red Norvo began to work steadily in the studios of New York, usually playing the commercial pop music of the day. It paid the bills, but wasn't very challenging. Red yearned for a way to play more jazz. When the opportunity came to take a band into the famous Door, a new club that had opened on New York's 52nd Street, Red reluctantly put one together, with himself as leader. The band was both distinctive and innovative. There was no piano or drums, just xylophone, bass, and guitar, along with trumpet, clarinet, and tenor saxophone. Again, historian Dick Sudhalter.
I think what strikes the ear most about the Norvo Sextet recordings is that he's looking for a way to form an ensemble which has a dynamic range wide enough to allow the xylophone to function organically without having to either be boosted artificially or electronically or be buried, which would be very, very easily done. All those musicians were conscious of dynamics and shading and the color potential of the blend, probably more so than most small groups operating at the time. You kind of had to be. Again, you come back to the nature of the xylophone. You can't get much volume out of a xylophone. Therefore, everything you do had to be couched not only at a dynamic level, but in a register which would not conflict with the register in which the xylophone was working.
The Red Norvo Swing Sextet, as it came to be called, was both a critical and popular success, especially among younger club-goers. In late 1936, Norvo took a gig at the Commodore Hotel in New York City and expanded the sextet to 13 pieces. This band was even more successful with both the public and the critics. Much of the success of what was now billed as Red Norvo and his orchestra came from the inventive arrangements of the band's young trumpeter, Eddie Sauter. Red worked closely with Sauter to make sure that his arrangements were musically exciting, but didn't overwhelm the delicate sound of his xylophone. Eddie Sauter.
So the emphasis was on playing softly. It really did play soft, so whether you did it on a clarinet or a saxophone didn't make very much difference. that was any specialty of Red's. That's what it was. He used to call it the subtle swing. That was his subtitle. I've always been attracted to that. Most exciting parts were when it was very, very soft, like a whisper sometimes.
After the Red Norvo Orchestra left the Commodore Hotel, they moved on to Chicago's Black Hawk Restaurant, where Mildred Bailey joined the band after their regular vocalist quit to get married. With Mildred now singing in the band, they became a sensation. Now billed as Mr. and Mrs. Swing, they were broadcast all over the country on radio.
Arranger Eddie Sampson is responsible for the next tune. It's one of the best in Red Norvo's catalog. Love Me or Leave Me.
Though they had regular network exposure and were held in great respect by other musicians, Red and Mildred's big band never seemed to inspire much excitement among the dancers, who flocked to see more hard-driving swing bands. Jazz critic George Simon.
The band never achieved its greatest popularity because it wasn't the kind of a band that would knock the public over on its ear. Red's sound was, the volume, I would say, was probably 50% of what the other bands were playing. I remember the sax section, it was practically whispering. It was a very subtle swinging band. Red's band underplayed everything. It was like holding hands with a girl and going no further.
After the big band broke up in 1939, Mildred went on to sing with Benny Goodman and then focused on a solo career. Red formed other big bands, but each of them folded for one reason or another. After his largest and most ambitious band went under in 1942, Red formed a much smaller seven-piece group to go into New York's famous Door nightclub. In the vibrant hothouse atmosphere of 52nd Street during the early 1940s, the Red Norvo Septet became one of the most popular attractions around. Specs Powell was the drummer in that band.
We had three voices out there. We had Aaron Sachs, Eddie Burt, we had Shorty Rogers. So with those three, we could get a number of sounds, and we would then mix that with the piano, and when you put it all together, it had all the dynamics. We had a book that we could play all soft music, and would swing nice and quiet. And if we had to break up the room, we could do that too. It was a good group, fun group. And we were knocked out. That strike killed us.
Due to the recording ban instituted by the Musicians Union during the war years, few jazz fans ever got to hear what the Norvo Septet sounded like. But Red knew what a great band he had and prevailed upon his friend George Simon, the editor of Metronome magazine, to record them privately.
Red wanted to have the band on record, and I had this single, one-track Presto recorder. I think it was a Presto. And we got them into in my living room, which was a former garage down on West 4th Street. And it was amazing how many guys, we could get into a small room and how on one mic we could pick up so much sound.
Mm-hmm. One Note Jive from a rare 1942 home recording of the Red Norvo Septet. By 1942, the war was on and the draft was breaking up bands across the country. Red's was no exception, as both Eddie Burt and Shorty Rogers went off to the Army. Another area of Red's life was also problematic, his increasingly difficult relationship with his wife, Mildred. Things had been rocky for several years, and their problems were only made worse by all the time they had spent working together. Eventually, they divorced. Though divorced, Red and Mildred continued working together. He joined her network radio show as music director in the mid-40s, and they did several record dates together before her untimely death in 1951. While Red was working on Mildred's radio show in 1944, he was approached by his old friend Benny Goodman to join Goodman's band. Jazz historian Phil Shapp.
The shift had been made. The xylophone or xylophone was displaced, and the vibes had been embraced by Red Norvo because it was expected of a mallet player. And now he's playing in Lionel Hampton's chair, literally. But one of the things that Red Norvo did, and I think it's one of the great triumphs of his career, is that when Goodman, you know, pulled out all the stops and called in some of that repertoire that was to be played at fast tempos with the vibes heavily featured, Red Norvo reached into a department of his kit bag of jazz swing that maybe he didn't even know he had, that he could just get everyone up on his back and carry them into the promised land of swinging good jazz. It's really one of Red's great triumphs.
While Red was playing with Benny Goodman, he still found time for other work. He played in various all-star concerts, and with the recording band now over, made many record dates as both a leader and a sideman. So many dates, in fact, that when he was approached by the owner of a new record label, Comet, Red told him to go away.
Well, the guy called me and said, I want you to date. I said, no, I'm tired of making dates. I said, if you let me get what I want to get, let me pay him what I want to pay him, I'll do it. So I thought that's the end of him. He called back a week or two later and said, okay.
Jazz historian Phil Shapp.
These Red Norvo Comet sides are wisely perceived by Red Norvo himself as a triumph in his career. Basically, he wanted to give an audio snapshot of what 52nd Street Jazz was about. He wanted to illustrate, which he did, that the tenor saxophone had supplanted the trumpet as the dominant solo horn in jazz, and he got Flip Phillips to do that. He wanted to illustrate the arrival of the bass as a solo instrument, and he was very wise in getting Slam Stewart to represent that. But most foresightedly is the inclusion of bebop. The avant-garde, Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker. Nobody was writing about them. They barely had any recordings on their own. Though Coleman Hawkins had made bebop records for Apollo over a year earlier, if you were not at a primary jazz record store in Midtown Manhattan in New York City, you wouldn't know about that. But the Comets, with Red Norvo's name on them, carrying the same musical message of Diz and Bird, those records you could get in Portland, Oregon, in Salt Lake City, Utah, in Austin, Texas, in Gary, Indiana. And they are perceived by a generation still living, major jazz musicians, as the first bebop records. Thank you.
Red Norvo's selected sextet and Congo Blues. By 1946, Red had become restless again, and he began looking for another musical challenge. He gave his notice to Goodman and was almost immediately approached by another clarinetist, Woody Herman. Gene Lees is author of the Woody Herman biography, Leader of the Band.
He developed an awful lot of the musicians who became the core of the great Woody Herman Band of 1944-45. When Red was with Benny Goodman, and Red told me he was getting bored with the Goodman Band, he said it was very good, but he was getting bored with it, Woody kept pressing him to come and join him. And he says, why not? He says, you know, Woody said, I've got most of your old band anyway. Why don't you come on over and join us?
Guitarist Tal Farlow saw Red perform with the Woody Herman Band.
His specialty was taking a standard. He would play it perhaps first as a ballad, and then he'd switch and make maybe to what might be called a swing tempo, and then it would go into a very fast section where he would really show off his technique. And, of course, that was quite impressive both to see and to hear.
Red Norvo performing I Surrender, Dear with Woody Herman and his Woodchoppers. When Herman broke up his big band in late 1946, Red moved to Los Angeles, where he and his second wife, Shorty Rogers' sister Eve, raised their two children, Portia and Kevin. Tired of being away from his family, Red formed a trio with guitarist Mundell Lowe. But with only guitar, bass, and vibes in the group, he found himself baffled and challenged.
And I actually didn't know what to do. I mean, I knew I had to play behind the guitar solos. I knew I had to play accompaniment behind the bass solo, besides playing a part maybe with Mundell. Boy, I felt like I had no clothes on or anything. It's just silly. I felt naked. I didn't know what to do.
Eventually, Red adapted to his new role. But after 3 months, his guitarist, Mundell Lowe, announced that he needed to return to New York City to reclaim his job as an NBC staff musician. Lowe was quick to suggest a replacement.
I had known this young guitar player working in New York City, so I said to Red, I've got to go back and claim my gig, so I've got somebody to take my place if you will take my word for their talent. And he said, well, who is he? And I told him, and he says, well, I never heard of this guy. I don't know him. I said, Red, believe me, he can play. And that fellow's name was Tal Farlow.
Farlow joined the band, and the group went off to Hawaii for an extended engagement. In Hawaii, their bass player gave notice, and Red began racking his brain for a suitable replacement. The pianist Jimmy Rolls suggested Charles Mingus, who had quit music after playing in Lionel Hampton's band and taken a job as a mail carrier in Los Angeles.
And so I got in touch with him. He was scared. He didn't want to do it. He had stopped playing. And I said, take your time. Come back. And every night he, I can't make it. I can't make it. And so he had wire strings on his bass. And I said, you're going to have to change those strings. So he got strings on and started to work. And so it got so that he was beginning to like it. And it started to go. That's the way the trio started.
Mingus wasn't the only one in the group with reservations about being able to keep up with Red's formidable technique. Guitarist Tal Farlow.
What he liked to do often was to play very fast, real fast. You know, he was very good at that. And that's what I remember from his being featured with Woody's band. And at that time, I really hadn't built much of a technique as far as that. I was more thinking in terms of chords and melodies and things like that. But a couple of times I got really scared. I said, Red, you know, I'm holding you back. And he said, no, you're not hanging there. So finally, I sort of worked out ways to keep up with him, I should call it. it was his challenge. We finally got it going, and then we like to build arrangements around that element of our playing.
The Norvo Trio with Tal Farlow and Charles Mingus stayed together for less than 2 years. First, Mingus left in a dispute over a TV show the group was supposed to play. Then Farlow seriously hurt his hand in an accident, forcing his temporary retirement. But Red stayed with the trio format for a few more years, recruiting several guitarists and bass players throughout the mid-50s. Red got steady work for his group in the casinos of Las Vegas, but found the long hours there taxing. He decided to expand his trio to a quintet to give himself a break from having to play constantly. He added a drummer and another soloist, saxophonist and flutist Jerry Dodgen. One of the great challenges for this group was how to engage an audience amidst the tumult of a casino. Jerry Dodgen.
Whenever we would play in a place that was really loud, and we'd start playing louder, he would say, no, don't play louder. Let's play softer. And we would play softer, and pretty soon there would be people listening. A few times we would do something like, we'd be playing something like When You're Smiling or something, and the crowd would be really loud and talking, and he would just whisper to us, fake the next chorus. In other words, pretend like you're playing. And so we wouldn't utter a sound. We'd pretend like we're playing for a whole chorus, and people are talking to each other, and they're doing double takes, looking at the band, and say, what's the matter? What's the matter? What is this? And now they're really looking at us and paying attention to us, and at the end of this chorus, we start playing just like we'd never stopped.
Spider's Web from the Red Norvo Quintet. One of the people most responsible for Norvo's success in Las Vegas was Frank Sinatra. Sinatra had long been a Red Norvo fan and helped him find work whenever he could. He had been instrumental in getting Red a steady engagement at the Sands Hotel and used him often in both his movies and recordings. Sinatra was delighted with the sound of Red's new quintet and in 1959 decided for the first time to go out on the road with Red's jazz combo instead of his orchestra.
People are all saying, my God, you sound better than you ever sound. He was easy, he was relaxed. The guys really enjoyed playing for him. And he felt like he was a musician with us, you know? He felt confident.
Night and day, you are the one. Baby, where you are, I think of you.
in that roaring traffic's boom. In the silence of my lonely room, how I think of you.
Frank Sinatra and the Red Norvo Quintet performing Night and Day from a live recording made in Melbourne, Australia in 1959. After the tour with Sinatra ended, Red stayed busy throughout the 1960s. He performed with Benny Goodman, worked in Las Vegas, toured internationally, and appeared often on television. But an accident on a shooting range in the mid-60s seriously damaged Red's hearing, causing him great pain and lingering problems on the bandstand for years to come. Then in the early 70s, two more tragedies struck. First, the death of his teenage son Kevin in 1970. Then the loss of his wife Eve to cancer in 1972. These last two events brought Red to the brink of despair, and he decided to give up playing altogether. But his musician friends coaxed him out of retirement, and he began another productive period of his already productive career. He made numerous recordings and performed at concerts and festivals around the world. One such concert was a reunion of swing-era musicians that brought Red together with old friends Benny Carter, Freddie Green, and Teddy Wilson. Jazz historian Phil Schaap was in the audience that night.
And had there been a scrim on the stage, his age could never have been determined by what he played. Outside of the pianist, Teddy Wilson, it was Red Norvo alone who took on the challenge of playing alone, offering us Dances in Love from Duke Ellington's Perfume Suite, charmed everyone. And I remember that the great glory is that although it was something of a last hurrah kind of packaging, this swing reunion in March of 1985 at Town Hall, it was still Red Norvo in another day on another bandstand playing the same genius that he had been capable of, but with a freshness. Again, this was a new day, and he was just as great as ever.
I'd like to play for you now a number written by one of my favorite composers, Duke Ellington. It's called Dancers in Love.
In 1986, a year after this recording, Red Norvo suffered a massive stroke. He lost the use of his left side and was unable to play his beloved mallet instruments anymore. Though his body is failing him, Red Norvo's mind and spirit remain strong. Vibraphonist Gary Burton.
I think one way to describe Red, my personal view of him, I would say, is that Red is a survivor. This is a guy who has had a very long career. He's had a long life. It's almost as if he's had one career after another over the years. And even now, I get this same feeling that he's still surviving. He's still hanging on and doing, you know, what he can, thinking about music, trying to play tunes on his keyboard instrument. This is a guy who has passed through many phases of his career and outlived many of his family and friends and has continued on. So I think I will always see him this way.
They called him Mr. Swing, Our tribute to the life and music of Red Norvo was written and produced by Dan Gettiman. Special thanks to John McDonough, Gunnar Jacobson, Herb Young, Rusty Dedrick, John Steiner, Jim Mayer, Ralph Burns, Aaron Sachs, Bill Kirshner, David Deal, A.V. Bonds, and Michael Kiefer. We'd also like to thank Gus Frederick and the Wolverine Antique Music Society, the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University, and the Smithsonian Institution Jazz Oral History Program. Jazz Profiles is produced by Tim Owens, assistant producer Madeline Smith, executive producers Mary Beth Kirshner and Murray Horwitz. To email us or for more information about Jazz Profiles, this program, and a listing of future programs in the series, look for NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web at npr.org. That's npr.org. Major support for Jazz Profiles comes from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people make the arts part of their everyday lives. Additional support has been provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Nancy Wilson, and this is NPR, National Public Radio.
You've been listening to an encore broadcast of Jazz Profiles. Red Norvo died at the age of 91 on April 6th, 1999.